going to be turning to Colossians 4. Colossians chapter 4. I want to welcome you back out. Glad that you're here. I think we have an even better number tonight than we may have this morning. A lot of visitors, thankful that you're here with us. Turn with me. We're going to look at a lot of scriptures this evening. As we go through them, turn there, check them, make sure that we're using them the right way. Colossians 4, verse 6. And as you can see from the PowerPoint behind me, we're going to talk about the way we talk as Christians. Our speech is so important, and obviously it's something we do all the time, but our words reflect on the Lord, and our words reflect on how other people see His people and how they see Him. So obviously very important. Colossians 4, look at verse 5. Walk in wisdom toward those who are outside, redeeming the time. And by outside, those who are not part of the body of Christ. Verse 6. Let your speech always be with grace, seasoned with salt, that you may know how you ought to answer each one. So this is specifically given for how to talk with those who are outside of the Lord, who are not faithful Christians. And just as we go through it, let's break down this verse. Let your speech always be with grace. What is grace? It's goodwill, kindness. We've talked about grace before. Let your speech always be with kindness and goodwill. This seems so easy. This seems such a simple principle. Is your speech always with kindness and goodwill? For those of us who use sarcasm, we better be careful. For those of you guys who use sarcasm, you better be very careful. It's easy, isn't it? You start out as a joke. It's meant to be just kind of this little quip, but easily it can cut to the heart. It can end up being not very kind at all and not seeming to inspire any goodwill. It can go the opposite direction. This is something for all of us that we need to be careful and we need to work on. Is my speech with grace? Whatever comes out of my mouth, is it? Could someone say, that was a graceful way of speaking there? Even if we rebuke somebody, our ultimate goal should be their goodwill. When you rebuke someone, what's your purpose? Is it to show them how good of a Bible student you are? Or is it because you want them to go to heaven? That ought to be our goal. So that's goodwill, grace, kindness. That should be our goal always. The second part, seasoned with salt. I don't remember where I heard this. Probably in a commentary somewhere. They describe that seasoned with salt as flavored with spiritual wisdom. I like that. I like that description. That makes a lot of sense. You take spiritual wisdom and that should affect, it should flavor the word choice you use and the way that you say it. It should affect every part of that. Our words ought to carry the wisdom of scriptures with them. This is so important in talking to the lost. Pensacola, Florida is about an hour away from where we grew up, and there at one of the main intersections, this local religious college would send its students down there, and they would stand on each of the corners. And as cars went by, it's a busy. It's Davis Highway in Pensacola, extremely busy. They would yell at the cars, and they would point and angrily say, "You're going to hell! You're going to hell!" They would do that for like 3 or 4 hours. Just take a guess about how effective you think that was. You know, people are just driving by, trying to go to the mall, and you got these 19-year-old screaming at you that you're going to hell? How effective is that? Now, was that a true statement for many of the people driving by? Probably so. But how effective? Was it seasoned with salt is my question. Does it go back to the first part? Did it have any goodwill behind it? Sure didn't seem like it. They were self-righteous. They were accusing and hateful. Definitely not seasoned with salt. Ironically, that school teaches false doctrine, so there's a whole other facet of it. So that way that we approach others could do more damage than good. Now, we can't avoid teaching truth just because it might hurt somebody's feelings. We have to address that. But even though there may not be a perfect way of saying something, some ways are worse than others. So we should consider, before we say it, think about what's about to come out of my mouth. Look at this last part. That you may know how you ought to answer each one. This just takes time. It takes patience. It takes going to God in prayer and asking for wisdom. It takes seeking wisdom from Christians who are a lot more experienced with that sort of thing than we are. This takes time. knowing how you ought to answer each one, you don't answer each one the same. There are some times where you've got someone who is stubborn, they know truth, and they are just being hard-headed. I'm not going to answer him the same way as I would someone who is just totally in ignorance and just doesn't know what God's Word says about it. One of them is a stubborn rebel. The other one is honestly clueless. There's a different approach for that. And this takes time, again, patience and prayer to know how we ought to answer. Turn to James chapter 3. James 3. We'll start in verse 3. James, of course, gives us a lot of information about the tongue and the role it plays and just how dangerous it can be if it's not controlled. We're not going to read this entire section. We really could. But let's read 3 through 5 together. James 3. Indeed, we put bits in horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn their whole body. Look also at ships. Although they are so large and are driven by fierce winds, they are turned by a very small rudder wherever the pilot desires. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. Well, it doesn't take much to set the world on fire. Just a few words, just a few sentences on Facebook, and you can start a forest fire. It's always been that way. And this is the warning there. Make sure you keep this thing under control. Now, on the flip side, can you do good with the tongue and with our speech? Yeah. The gospel, the word of light and life, how is it taught? Primarily through speaking, teaching, preaching. So obviously there's much good that can be done, but control it. Keep wraps over it. So our question tonight is, what is our speech like? And individually, let's look at this and be honest with ourselves. Is my speech the way that's being described in Colossians 4:6, or is it something I need to work on? Let's start with how we speak to those who are outside of the Lord's church, those who are lost. People become Christians because they hear God's word, they believe it, they obey it. Romans 10:17. If we're ever going to teach anybody the truth, how do we approach them? Well, one way, how should my speech be toward them? It ought to be long-suffering. And the idea there is patient. Do I listen to other people? Here's the ironic part about long-suffering speech means maybe I don't talk very much at all. Maybe I just listen to them. Some of the most faithful Christians I know, well, let me take it back. All of the most faithful Christians I know are really, really good listeners. Does that strike you as odd? It shouldn't. He's given us two ears and one mouth. Do we use them in that proportion or do we reverse it? Are we constantly having to say something, constantly the ones to talk? Because what I need to do is probably patiently listen. How in the world can I know to answer your question if I haven't even heard the question? How can I know what advice to give you if I don't even know what the problem is? So maybe the start here is just be quiet and listen. Hear the whole thing out. And then when I do speak, obviously, do so carefully. James 1, verse 9. So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Proverbs 18. I want to turn there. I mentioned to you, we're going to be moving around through Old Testament and New. I want to look at a number of scriptures tonight. Proverbs 18. Look at verse 13. We're talking about the importance of hearing, being slow to speak, weighing things and engaging them. A side point, if I'm always talking about me, I'll never find out enough about others to be able to do them any good. Proverbs 18, verse 13, he who answers a matter before he hears it, it is folly and shame to him. You ever done that? You ever answered a matter before you heard it? It's easy, so easy. We hear three words and we are just dying to answer and give some brilliant piece of wisdom. And we didn't even hear the whole story. Apparently, Solomon's day, they had the same problem. Man hasn't changed much over the years. Long-suffering, patient speech. Another thing is speech that's trustworthy. Matthew 5, verse 7. You're familiar with this. In the Sermon on the Mount, so many different things in there that it is amazing to me how much ground Jesus covers in three chapters. I mean, he is just going point to point. He covers the entirety of life, it seems, in just that short amount of time. Well, one of the things, verse 37, certainly talking about the idea of not swearing and that sort of thing, but look at verse 37. Let your yes be yes, and your no, no, for whatever is more than these is from the evil one. But what goes with that point? So you don't need to make these grand vows. You don't need to swear on the temple and swear on all this. If you say yes, it ought to be yes. To the best of your ability, if you say no, it's no. Am I trustworthy? Because if people in the world can't trust me to talk to them about worldly things, how in the world are they going to be able to listen and trust you and me when we start talking about spiritual things? We should be trustworthy in our speech. To the best of our knowledge, these things are right. Turn to Philippians 4. Philippians chapter 4. Is my speech joyful? Philippians 4, verse 4. Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Do people come away from you and me? Those of us who are Christians, do they come away from us feeling energized and encouraged? Or are we emotional vampires who just suck the life out of people? You ever been in a conversation like that? Well, you go in, you're kind of excited, and you're happy to see somebody, and after 5 minutes, the color of your skin has changed because the very life of it has been sucked out. It's just so wearying. Constant complaining, constant bickering. Over God's people ought not be like that. We ought not talk like that. There should be joy in our speech. And I know there are times when we're going to be sad. I'm not saying jump up and down at a funeral and run and cheer through the hallway. It's time to be appropriate. But our speech, we ought to be joyful people, and it ought to be reflected in the things that we say. Philippians chapter 2. Verse 14. Is this me? Do all things without complaining and disputing. Why? Verse 15, that you may become blameless and harmless, children of God without fault, in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you shine as lights in the world. Is that me? Do I shine like that? Am I avoiding complaining and disputing? Turn to Acts chapter 16. I am thankful that the first Christians I met were joyful people. Because it could have turned me the other way. If I had met some brethren who really, really just get caught up in their woes and they allow themselves to be weighed down and they weigh others around them down, I don't know the impression I might have had with it. I'm glad I came in contact with the ones I did first, those who do have joy in the Lord. Look at Acts 16. You know where we are. Paul and Silas at this point start in around verse 20, they have gotten into trouble. Paul has cast out this evil spirit. The owners of a slave girl are not happy with him. They get tossed into prison. Verse 20, they brought him to the magistrates. They get in trouble. Drop down to verse 23. When they had laid many stripes on them, they threw them into prison, commanding the jailer to keep them securely. Having received such a charge, he put them into the inner prison and fastened their feet in the stocks. So they beat them. They tore off their clothes before that, so it's nasty. And then they take them and put them in the inner prison, and they fasten their feet in the stocks. There's nothing about that that makes me happy. I can't even smile reading it. It's awful. And yet, look at the very next verse, verse 25. But at midnight, Paul and Silas were praying and singing hymns to God, and the prisoners were listening to them. How do you do that when you have been beaten for no cause, by the way? You've been thrown into the prison, and they put your feet in stocks. What would you be doing? What would I be doing right about midnight time when I wish I could sleep, but I'm in stocks, so there's no way to get comfortable? They are singing and praying and praising the Lord. There's joy in their hearts. There's joy in those songs, that speech, if you will, for our purposes. Is that the case in my life? Even when things are hard, even when things are rough, is that the kind of speech that I emanate, that I give off? It's what my Lord deserves. Turn to Acts 13. And this is a general way of talking about just a couple pages back, probably, in most of your Bibles. When we're dealing with those, when we're talking with those who are not Christians, does my speech honor the Lord? Explain what I mean. Does Jesus find his way into my conversations? Or do I never really talk about him much? Yeah, I'm a Christian. I've been born again. My sins have been washed away, and I don't talk about him much. I don't bring him up in my conversations very much. Something's wrong with that picture. Look at Acts 13, starting verse 14. They're at Antioch in Pisidia. But when they departed from Perga, John Mark has just left and gone back to Jerusalem. They came to Antioch in Pisidia, and they went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and sat down. After reading the law and the prophets, the rulers of the synagogue said to them, "Men and brethren, if you have any word of exhortation for the people, say on." Let me just give these guys some advice. If you don't want Paul to talk, you better not invite him to. Because basically they said, "Men," they see Paul and Barnabas in there, "do you have something you would like to say?" Well, what's Paul's answer? "You know what I do. I do. There is something I'd like to say." And starting in verse 16, we're told he stood up. Basically, he goes through the history of the Jews for them there, getting to King David. Now, remember what we're talking about, speech that honors the Lord. He could just go through and give them a history lesson on the Jews, and that would be good. But what does he do? Where does he go from David? Drop down, look at verse 22. "When he had removed him," speaking of Saul, "he raised up for them David as king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, 'I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do all my will.'" And you can just imagine how the Jews are feeling now. This is their hero. This is David. They honor him. You've got their attention now. Where does he go next? Verse 23. "From this man's seed, according to the promise," you remember the promise that was made, "God raised up for Israel a Savior, Jesus." And he begins talking about the Lord there. That is some skill. That is the way my conversations need to go. Do I work Jesus into conversations like this? Because I am telling you, I can work Auburn football into any conversation at all. It's raining outside. I remember when I watched Auburn in the rain at one time. I mean, you could do it anyway. We can do this with our sports and our hobbies. Why can't we do it with the Lord? For everything he's done for me, shouldn't I be able to work him into a conversation? Man, it is a beautiful day outside. It is. And the Lord has blessed us with it. Can't we do that at least? Work him into it. If he's that important to us, surely we can get him into these conversations. Well, let's talk about who else we speak to. How about when we're talking to brethren? Is my speech seasoned with salt when I'm talking to brethren? Turn to Romans 12, verse 10. "Do I talk to you like I prefer you?" It ought to be obvious. It should be obvious that we prefer one another. Romans chapter 12. Look at verse 10 there. "Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another." And he goes on, "not lagging in diligence, but fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing." But that verse 10, "Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love, in honor giving preference to one another." Who are your favorite people? My favorite people ought to be my brethren. And when I talk to you, it ought to be obvious to you that you don't inconvenience me. And you're not the people I got to be around on Sundays. These are the people who mean the most to me. Is that the way that I address my brethren? Our speech ought to build one another up. When things fall apart, who are the first human beings you go to? Now, certainly we should go to the Lord first, but shouldn't our brethren be right there at the top of that list? When things are fantastic and I'm rejoicing over things, who should be the first human beings I go to? Again, brethren should be there at the top of that list. We ought to have that relationship with one another. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. I should never talk down to brethren. They were bought with the same blood I was. I should never talk down to them like they're some kind of inferior, lesser beings. Now, this does not mean I never rebuke them. If the rebuke is necessary, we must give it. That's part of showing love for them. But I should never look down my nose at those there may be a temptation as we study, as we learn more, to get a little high and mighty, to talk to those who haven't been Christians very long and they make a mistake and you're like, oh, how could you not know? Well, because he doesn't know it. Now I can either act like that or I can help him see it so he does know it, so next time it doesn't happen again. What's my approach in this? 2 Thessalonians 3:14 and 15. If anyone does not obey our word in this epistle, note that person. Do not keep company with him that he may be ashamed. Obviously, there's discipline there. But look at verse 15. It's so important. Yet do not count him as an enemy, but admonish him as a brother. Don't treat him like an enemy. He's still your brother. You want him to go to heaven ultimately. That should be the end goal. Is that how I talk to my brethren? Like I want them to go to heaven? Turn to Ephesians 5. What about our spouses? How do we talk to our spouses? It is amazing to me that the people we love the most in this world catch the absolute worst of us. I don't know how it works out like that. It's probably because we know they'll stick around. So we're just bad about that. Look at verse 33. Let's start with wives. Wives, does your speech show that you respect your husband? Ephesians 5, verse 33. Nevertheless, let each one of you in particular so love his own wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Turn to 1 Peter 3. We'll start in verse 5. 1 Peter 3. Verse 5, for in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands, as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord, whose daughters you are if you do good and are not afraid with any terror. And we're told here that Sarah called Abraham Lord. Not that she worshipped him, that's not the idea here, but she honored him. She respected him. And in the way that she addressed him, there was honor and respect in that, not because he was perfect, but because she honored the position that God had given to him. Now, do you honor and respect your husband, ladies? Does your speech honor and respect him? Or do you nag his eyes out? And this is a reality. I know there are people who hate to hear these verses read, but we're going to read them anyway. Go to Proverbs 21. Solomon has seen fit to give us this. Do you build your husband up? Do you respect him and treat him with honor in your speech? Proverbs 21, verse 9. Better to dwell in a corner of a housetop than in a house shared with a contentious woman. Same chapter, verse 19. Better to dwell in the wilderness than with a contentious and angry woman. Chapter 27, verse 15. A continual dripping on a very rainy day and a contentious woman are alike. Whoever restrains her restrains the wind and grasps oil with his right hand. Honest question and answer time. Is this you? Is this your approach? Because it can absolutely wreak havoc on your family. It can crush your husband, crush his spirit. It can take him for what he should be instead of being strengthened and built up to lead your family. Can knock his legs right out from under him. This is a warning. Solomon gives it. Let's look at it and take it to heart. Do your words help or hinder him in being the godly leader that he should be? This is a big deal. It's important. Turn back to Ephesians 5. Let's look at the other side. Husbands, does my speech show that I cherish my wife? Ephesians 5, verse 25. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. Verse 28, so husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it just as the Lord does the church. Cherish means to, literally means to keep warm. That the idea there in the Greek word. My love for her is such that my words bring comfort and protection to her. Is that true? When I speak, does my wife know that I cherish her? Go to 1 Peter 3 again. We'll look at verse 7. Can my wife tell that I cherish her by the way I speak? 1 Peter 3, verse 7. Husbands, likewise, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, and as being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. So let's work back from the bottom. First of all, if I don't treat her the right way, my relationship with God is now messed up, and it's my fault. Because I didn't treat her with the honor she deserves, God doesn't hear my prayers anymore. So this is a big deal. But now, coming back from the top, dwelling with them with understanding. The world hates what I'm about to say, but I know it's shocking. Men and women are different. We really are. We're different. We think differently. We have different approaches to things, and God made us that way. The world seems to hate that idea and try to cast it aside. We're different, and that's okay. We're supposed to be. We were made different. And when we come together, it can be amazing. That's the whole plan. That's how the family is built to work. We shouldn't be ashamed of these things. So for that to work, though, husbands, we're going to have to dwell with them with understanding. Because Sasha's idea of how things should go is not going to be the same way as my idea of how things should go. Key example, when she gives me an idea for a sermon, and she says, here, I was thinking about this, I think you should preach on this, and she gives me a couple verses, and I say, man, that's fantastic, I love it. I go and write the sermon and preach it, and I say, what do you think? She said, that is not the sermon that I gave you. It's not even remotely where I meant for you to go. Because we're different, and that's okay, but it's going to take patience to dwell with each other with understanding. Now, notice, let's read through it again. Dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife. The position of wife is a position of honor. Do we get that? It's a position of honor. It is an honorable position. Now look at the next thing that's said, because you want to make somebody mad, just read this part of the verse. As to the weaker vessel. And this is the point in time of the verse where many want to break out boxing gloves and get all mad about it. And they say, what an insult. Weaker vessel. That is a put down. Is it an insult? Is this insulting women? For those who claim that the Bible insults women, I advise them to read the Bible. Maybe check out Proverbs 31. Just take a look at it. It is ridiculous, and it's one of those things that gets on my nerves. But here, let's go through it and see if we can get from this what it's saying. As the weaker vessel, weaker here does not mean less important by any means. It just said give honor to them because they're honorable. They're worthy of that. Men are like that old, thick coffee mug. You know, the one that's made of granite that most men have in their house. It doubles as an anchor when you go fishing. It's like the best paperweight ever. It's just this massive mug. Maybe my dad is the only one in creation who had it. Maybe this is just peculiar to me. But he had this coffee mug that you could seriously do anything. You could use it a baseball bat. It is thick and heavy and rugged and rough. And he would just take it and throw it over there. And it's fine. Whatever it hit may not be. But it's fine. Rough and rugged and tough, and that's what men are. On the flip side, would you take a piece of fine china and throw it around like that? Would you take a piece of fine china and just sling it and see where it lands? No, because it's delicate, right? It is more delicate. It's to be handled with gentleness. Does that mean it's worth less? You put a price tag on the fine china and the hunk of granite. Which one do you think gets the higher price? Just because it's more delicate doesn't mean it's worth less. And that's what people fail to see with this. This is a position of honor. My wife is to be honored by me. She is weaker in a sense. She is more delicate, and to be treated with gentleness, it doesn't mean she's worth less. And our society has this idea so messed up. And both our actions and our words, our wives ought to be treated with honor. Turn to Proverbs 15. When this is not done, you can destroy your whole house. When this doesn't happen as it should, it wreaks havoc. Proverbs 15, verse 1. A soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger, and then it just goes on and on and on. How many times have harsh words poisoned a marriage? And then not only our marriage, but if our children hear that, it may be poisoning theirs down the road. Watch your tongues. Be careful with the way we speak. Turn to Ephesians chapter 6. Ephesians 6. Let's talk about children speaking to parents. Ephesians 6, verses 1 and 2. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment, with promise, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. Children, do you speak to your parents with honor? Obviously, God told you to, so you should. But your parents are not your chauffeurs, and they are not your personal bankers, and they are not your private chefs. They are the king and queen of your home. Do you treat them with that respect? And ironically, for those who don't, you're going to wish you had when you have a family of your own. Yeah, there's so many times that I can think back and like, oh, this is what it felt like. This is what mom, okay, now it makes sense now. This is so important. When that respect is not there, it destroys the whole family dynamic. This includes listening when they speak. Have you ever pretended that you didn't hear what your parents were saying to you? You did, but you didn't act like you did. Do you think you're honoring them in the Lord when you treat them like that? For younger children who are in here, here's a question for you. My kids, especially. When your parents have to tell you multiple times it's time to go, are you honoring the Lord? Or are you dishonoring Him and them by your actions? Things to consider. Drop down two verses to Ephesians 6, verse 4. Now let's flip this over for us as parents. Verse 4, and you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. Fathers are specifically targeted here, so let's go with that. Do we provoke our children to wrath by the way we speak, by the way that we deal with them? Do we encourage them when they do right, or do we always have to find a flaw? They can never truly be successful because I will always find a flaw with what they did. And I am constantly just weighing them down and weighing them down. Do I provoke them with my actions and with my words? Do I give them what they need, or do I shoo them away because I'm checking Facebook on my phone? I don't have time for them right now. Why do you keep coming to me with this stuff? Which one is me? Do I take the time to answer their questions and deal with their problems? What's my tone like? What is my tone like when my children come to me? When maybe I am busy with something. Do I snap at them and bite their heads off? Or do I make sure they know that whatever is important to them is important to me? Because here's the thing. If I train them now that daddy doesn't have time to deal with your stuff, when they're 16 and 17 and 21 and 30, do you think they're going to come to daddy with their problems? If I show them early on, I don't have time to deal with you right now. You're getting on my nerves, kid. Then when things are serious problems, it's more than just a doll got its leg ripped off. I don't know what that says about my daughters. That happens constantly in our house. It's been a thing this week. But if I don't care about that and spend any time with that, then when they've got serious problems down the road, are they going to trust me enough to come to me? What does my tone say? The way I speak to them, what am I telling them? Proverbs 15, verse 28. Have it up here for you. I suspect this is something every one of us struggles with. Our speech. Putting the right control on it. Saying things in the right way. Verse 15, verse 28. The heart of the righteous studies how to answer, but the mouth of the wicked pours forth evil. This is a good start. Pause before we answer. Think about what we're about to say rather than just letting it pour out. Another way of saying it, weigh your words before you speak them. Go ahead and get your songbooks out. I know there's nothing new in anything that I said this evening. I know it's nothing that you haven't heard before. But I know this is something I struggle with, so you guys have to suffer through it too. I suspect it's more than just me. This is how people see the Lord, through the way His people act, through the way His people talk. Is one way that people come to know the Lord and see what He's about. What are we showing them? If I haven't seasoned my speech with salt, I need to do it now. Maybe publicly I've done something in a way, said something in a way that needs to be corrected. I can do that tonight. I can get your help with that. You can do it as well. If we can help in any way, please come as we stand and sing.